I think they like you, Steve.
Thursday, okay? Just remember Thursday. Thursday. Can you remember Thursday?
Live from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
It's the Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Morning, Chicago. 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here, stepping up for Steve Cochran today. He's back tomorrow. The gang's all here, though. Mary Sandberg, Dave Bennett, Mary Vandeveld, Steve Grzanich. A great show lined up today. We're going to have Chuck Todd, of course, as we do every Thursday, coming up here in the 6 o'clock hour, as well as Nick DiGilio. Coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, we'll talk politics. A new candidate has stepped into the race for Chicago mayor. She's been there before, Amara Enya. We're going to talk with Amara. She'll be in studio coming up in the 7 o'clock hour to not only kind of declare, I guess, announce her candidacy, but to talk about why she's doing it again. She ran for mayor back in 2015. Amara is a tremendous educator and activist and advocate here in Chicago, and looking forward to hearing why she wants to be the mayor of Chicago. It's coming up. I don't know why anyone would want to do
that. I was going to say, that's not, except for Dave Bennett. I think that he's planning on running.
You'd be a good mayor?
I no interest, really, but thanks.
Dave's a uniter, though.
Yeah.
Mr. Cat, he's already famous here. So
you have to be a uniter, and you have to be a motivator, and you have to be able to deal with a lot of people coming in going, Dave, can you help me, Dave? Dave, can you do that?
I don't have time.
Well, 312-981-7200. I hesitate to say that the text question should be about what would you, what kind of mayor would you be, or what would you do, what would be the one thing you do as mayor, because I feel like it'll be all political and serious.
Yeah, but that's not very fun.
Yeah, but maybe if you can get past your first reaction to say you would, I'd bring taxes down.
Right.
Go to your second one, that might be good. 312-981-7200.
I'd go with a 4-day work week.
See? Out of the box thinking.
Yeah, that's
would you make the days longer? Would you stay with the idea of a 40-hour week?
Yeah, or 38, or whatever. They always do that weird number. But
yeah, right.
Yeah, I would do that, but a 4-day work week.
Right.
And I would like to do Monday and Friday flex, so you pick your off. I prefer to have Fridays off. The Monday holiday seems depressing because it's just like getting two Sunday nights to me.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's a great point. That is really a good point.
Yeah, Sunday nights always bite, don't they?
Right. So that so
and then it's always like a big football yep. game on at night or something, like an awards night on a
right.
Sunday
but
night.
Thursday night, if you have Friday off, you're like, this yep. is the you greatest.
I love Thursdays are like one of my favorites.
There you go. You've already got a vote.
I know.
Mary's in.
You got two.
Two.
I'm there.
I have always said this about the federal, like anyone running for president, and I'm surprised that President Trump didn't get on this train. I guess my stance is anti-capitalist, but I think there should not be an airline ticket over $300.
Okay. Oh, I agree.
And I just feel like that, if you came in right now and Trump did one of his tweets that was like, oh, the industry, they're terrible, sad, the whole hashtag this, hashtag that, about when the prices go up and you get gouged for going to Cleveland, I think you'd win so many votes. That would be that's the swing vote.
I'll keep everything $275.
Okay, so far there have been two really good proposals on this show in the first 14 minutes.
I'd bring back Prohibition just so that I could get some sweet, sweet cash for bringing booze back underneath the streets, you know what I'm saying?
Right. You'd be the Acapulco 2018.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. There are other substances if you just want to try. They're still prohibited. So. Yeah.
And Joe, you could do it without committing a crime.
Yeah, right.
Too.
Hey, I'll be my own mayor, Dave.
Are more people jumping on my Cinnabon idea?
Oh yeah, yeah. This is all off of Grzanich wants to bring a Cinnabon. He wants to invest.
A franchise.
And I think Mary's idea was better, which is just a Cinnabon smell, a scent. Maybe a candle store, but
yeah,
just
we don't
the scent.
Need the calories. We just need the
that
smell.
That is the best smell though at the mall,
man.
Right.
And Mrs. Fields cookies.
Yeah, those are good, too.
I'm in. I said
and Aunt Annie's pretzels.
Oh, yeah.
And Gloria Jeans.
Oh, yeah. There you go. So,
we're just going to keep going.
We need a mall.
And a merry-go-round.
We don't need any more coffee,
I'll
though.
Collect your checks by 8 o'clock this morning. 10,000 each.
Good. All right, Joe, let's do top 6 at 6.
Steve Cochran Auditorium in the
the lovely Sunrise Hotel. It's time to get your kicks.
Get your kicks.
Get your kicks. Get your kicks. With the top 666, sponsored by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60-Minute Men.
Fallout continues after yesterday's guilty parade of President Trump's former associates, and it may not be over as Michael Cohen's lawyer, the lawyer's lawyer, suggesting that there could be more damaging secret information on the president, is requesting a meeting with special counsel Robert Mueller. Meanwhile, the president went to Fox News and Twitter to belittle the Manafort and Cohen news, suggesting that the news clears him rather than implicates him. Very interesting way that the White House has developed strategy on this. And the strategy is this has nothing to do with us. And if anything, if you read between the lines, this is what we were saying all along. We're innocent. This is a weird way to look at that. But you know what? And this is America, and there are different ways to look at every story, right?
Everybody has a side, right?
That's right. Democrats are lining up today to press congressional leaders to put a hold on the confirmation of Supreme Court choice Brett Kavanaugh. The Democrat senator from Hawaii suggests that Kavanaugh was handpicked by Trump to help with oncoming legal trouble, not to serve the nation. They want the process halted till the Russia investigation is over or the midterms come and go. One of the two. Not to be cynical on that. But then again, I would be the first to say, no, don't play politics with the Supreme Court. We just went through 2016, when that's all Congress did. They just played politics with the Supreme Court, with Merrick Garland and Kasich, or Gorsuch, and everyone in between. So I just feel like, I don't know if they can prove that the president was thinking in his best interest or his own self-interest by selecting someone who would help him, because Kavanaugh said in one of the interviews that he believes that there should be immunity to the president when it comes to prosecution.
Right.
And so, if you're one of those people that believe that a president can't select a Supreme Court nominee in his last year of office,
right?
What about if you're under investigation?
That's my point. Yeah, that's exactly my point. I would have said maybe 2-3 years ago, keep politics out of it. But obviously, things have changed. Speaking of Hawaii, Hurricane Lane hitting landfall this morning. The Category 4 storm expected to come with tornadoes, flooding, high winds, massive power outages. The state of Hawaii, surprisingly, is not equipped with enough local shelters. And that's a serious worry there. That's surprising to me.
You would think, because they have a lot of weather.
I guess that's an issue, because they don't know where to put the people, and it's one that I guess have there not been hurricane scares in Hawaii?
I haven't heard of any.
We saw Tom Skilling say last night that there has never been something like this in this location heading this way.
Wow.
Is that, Steve, are you going to?
I was just going to say, I think there's been 3 hurricanes over the modern history.
Wow.
Yeah, they get typhoons, right?
Yeah, they're typhoons. But, and the one hurricane was not this strong that hit. I think it was, I can't remember the name of it. It had a Hawaiian sounding name.
Every gas station in Florida is a local shelter. Yeah. And you know, maybe just in that state, right?
The other problem with Hawaii is that, you know, it's very mountainous, and the vegetation is such that if they get heavy rains, you're talking about mudslides there, which is going to be really bad.
There was video, I think Jim Cantore sent it out on Twitter, from a plane over the eye of the hurricane. Ooh. And it's, first of all, the people who go in these planes in the middle of the storm, I can't even imagine what that's like. But they were tracking this thing, and it was huge. It's just massive.
Well, we'll be watching that story all day today. Locally, a verdict in the murder trial of Chicago teenager Hadiyah Pendleton. Kenneth Williams was convicted yesterday. He was the getaway driver in the 2013 shooting. Mikhail Ward's trial, the alleged shooter, his trial continues. Pendleton was killed on a playground in 2013. Her case became a national story. One of the first Chicago murders to become a national story, thanks to the Obamas. And I think the Pendletons have been at the White House, they've been the State of the Union, and they have really been out front, the parents, in really bringing more awareness to gun violence and what was happening here and continues to happen in the city of Chicago. So it's just amazing it took 5 years for this trial, which took a couple of days for them to go, oh, these guys did it. Now, there are questions. I was reading the stories today, and you start to head scratch a little bit, because the defense for this kid says he wasn't, you know, he didn't have, there's no, it's all circumstantial evidence, and that there was a lot of the witnesses were coerced by police because they needed to find shooting. And you hear this every time. You're like, now it's becoming a legal maneuvering or a strategy, if you will. Or is it true?
You know, that's the thing. That's what happens when you have John Burge and things like that in the Chicago police, that you're like, ugh. But at the same time, we were just talking about Pete and I right before he came on. The kid, the getaway driver, he didn't go to the stand.
Right.
So then you're like, well, I don't know what to tell you. Why not get up there and say that? Why not get up there and say, I didn't know the other guy and he jumped in my car and he told me to drive? And, you know, I don't understand. It's a legal strategy that backfired on them. And so now they're going to say, oh, well, he was coerced, or witnesses were coerced. You had a chance in that moment to tell your story to the jury and you chose not to.
Even if he took the stand and was found guilty, they would probably say that, you know, same that's thing, how yeah. that works. Yeah.
This is like a story out of Black Mirror, show on Netflix. This is terrible. When technology goes bad, firefighters in California are accusing Verizon of throttling their internet speeds during the recent blaze. The firefighters used too much data at once because they were accessing maps and other internet-based tools to fight the historic blaze. But that usage put them over their limit, so Verizon slowed their speed down to dial-up. The firefighters, I think there's a lawsuit, they are saying that they couldn't send an email. They couldn't access Google. It was back to AOL days of the 90s because Verizon said they went over their limit. And Verizon is not saying, no, we didn't. They're saying, oh,
right,
there was a mix-up.
Because everybody's data plan does that.
Right.
You get the little text message that says mm-hmm. you're going to be at lower speeds. I mean, does Verizon know this account is
question.
A group of
yeah.
firefighters?
Well, the question, in this case, when emergency, you know, when they need it and it's life and death and firefighters are on the line, there needs to be some ability for a corporation to understand that this is beyond them. And it's not about money. It's about saving lives or saving the planet or whatever, you know, with firefighters. So the idea that they didn't, and I guess there was some miscommunication with the customer service on this. They called and said, hey, what's up? And customer service didn't do anything. So there's going to be a lot of fallout from
Well, extended beyond that, Justin. I mean, you're talking about the firefighters in this case. What about for internet service for branches of government,
or, yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's all corporate, but still,
it's a
you
lot
would
of
think
questions.
There's
got
to be a way they can look at it and say, okay, we don't want to slow this internet speed.
Absolutely, I mean, and a lot of questions and some of the big issues that are happening at the FCC with net neutrality as well. And finally, a Wilmette mom is being investigated by child services after the mom let her 8-year-old daughter walk the dog around the block. A neighbor called to complain. You saw this story?
Yeah,
Dave,
I saw this.
This
is the dumbest. I just can't even. There was
what a world we're living
I mean,
in, huh?
Don't you think you just want to tell this person, not the mom,
right.
but this neighbor, just MYOB, yeah. right? I mean, just
right. Well, they claimed that the call said that the girl was 5 and playing by herself in a
right.
parking lot.
Right.
I don't. You know, I'm not. This is ridiculous. But if you know how many times something bad is happening and people don't say anything
yeah.
and they say,
it's
why didn't you
story.
Say, you know, so that person obviously thought they saw something inappropriate, but.
And it's hard because we live in a world now, especially in more congested areas where you just, it is abnormal to see a kid by themselves.
Which, of course, there was a time when
I
it
know,
wasn't,
right?
but,
I know.
But they called the police, but then they weren't satisfied with that, and then they called DCFS.
Yeah, that's
where I think they go too far.
Yeah.
So yesterday, after this story broke, I asked about 8 people who I know are parents, and about half of them sided with one side and half sided with the other side.
Yeah,
so,
really?
Yeah.
This makes Gladys Kravitz look like a hero. We loved her.
But it's weird that the resources are going to that when there's a little girl that was under a couch. You know,
oh, yeah, right,
year before.
Right. Her murder has still not been
Absolutely.
Solved.
Right. And then we've got a girl walking a dog. And
Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah.
That's your top 6 at 6.
That's it!
That's all today for the top 6 at 6.
No more!
Sponsored by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60 Minute Men.
He is Nick at night. Did Julio? He knows what shows are good. What's stinking? He's the only one. Who's in the know? I need to know what Nick is thinking. I need to know what Nick is thinking.
Nick DiGilio on the line with us as he is on Thursdays. Nick, good morning.
Morning.
Is this good night for you? It's always hard to say what time of day it is for someone who works.
I usually hit the hay right around when the yodeling dude falls off the mountain on Price is Right. That's when I usually go to bed.
Certainly, yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. So I want to talk about Back to the Future 3, which is going to be our next film club screening. But before we do that, what film did you and your parents see this past weekend?
We saw Alpha, which is the prehistoric sort of movie about the origin of man's best friend, about a lost boy in the middle of the wilderness trying to get his way back to his tribe, and he meets a wild dog, and they form a friendship. And it's just an old-fashioned adventure movie. I actually liked it. I thought it was really good. And it's one of the few movies that I recommend people see in 3D, because I often think 3D is like just a really great way to get $4 more out of your wallet.
Exactly.
But this, actually, we saw it in 3D, and it really worked well in 3D. It's a beautifully shot movie. There's nothing new about it. It's like an old-school adventure movie, boy, dog, you know, trying to make it through the wilderness, but we all liked it, and I thought it was solid. Didn't make any money over the weekend last weekend, but yeah. I still think it was pretty good.
Well, hey, Nick, who chooses these movies? You, your mom, your dad?
It depends. Sometimes it's me. Sometimes like my dad wants to. You know, both my parents want to see the one we're seeing on Saturday, which is shocking to me because we're going to go see the Happy Town Murders, which is the borderline X-rated Muppet movie. But, you know, my dad's like, oh, I got to see that. So,
all right, Back to the Future 3. This is a movie that's going to be next. Why choose Back to the Future 3? Everyone knows Back to the Future. Some will swear by 2. But 3, this is the Western, right? This is where you start to get out into the outer realm.
Well, there's a few reasons why we chose it. One, because we've already shown Back to the Future and Back to the Future Part 2.
Good.
And two, because this whole summer we've been doing Robert Zemeckis Fest, and every movie that we've done since May has been directed by Robert Zemeckis, so we thought to end the Zemeckis Fest, it would be cool to end the Back to the Future trilogy, and it's also a movie that I really love, that I think is vastly underrated, and one of the reasons I love it so much is because, one, it's a Western, and Zemeckis always wanted to direct a Western, and two, this one is really about Doc Brown. This one is Doc's story. It's Christopher Lloyd's story. He's got a love interest with Mary Steenburgen, and he really is the focus of the movie, and being a great supporting character in the first two movies, but then really sort of taking the reins in the third one, that meant a lot to me. So that's why we're showing it. I love that movie.
And I just saw this movie, and what I liked about it, which I didn't like about Back to the Future 2, everything in Back to the Future 2 was a wink and a nod to the first one. This one seemed to shy, they did a little bit in this one, but this was a little bit more, like you said, about Doc's story, and more straight ahead future time travel kind of thing.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I'm a fan of the second one. I like the second one a lot. But one of the things I love about the second one is that it is so, I mean, everything leads to another complication. Like, everything they do gets screwed up.
Yeah, right.
They have to go back in time. They got to go forward in time. They got to go back in time and forward in time. And yet they fix it all. That's the thing about Zemeckis and Gale, Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis, who write these movies. They have a tendency to make everything count. Like, every little frame, every little thing counts, and it counts towards them getting a solution. So the second one was all about, like, this bridge between the first one and the third one where they just had to fix a whole bunch of stuff 2 hours. And then the third one is more relaxed, where you can just, like, enjoy the Western aspect of it and the romance between Mary Steenburgen and Christopher Lloyd. I think as a trilogy, I think it's a pretty perfect trilogy.
And I think a great film to see back in the theater, and you could do that with the next film club screening, Back to the Future 3, September 11th at the AMC Rosemont 18. Nick DiGilio joins us every Thursday. Nick, thanks for staying up. Appreciate it.
All right, buddy. Take care.
That's it. I would love to see that. I might do that. That's a good one to go out and see Back to the Future 3.
Now, why did you just see it?
It was on HBO, I think, or it was like they had over the summertime, I was watching it and with Miles and trying to get him into Back to the Future. He didn't seem to care. all right. Coming up, Chuck Todd, and also just a programming note that we're having some technical difficulties with our web and our engineering, and they're on it, and they're working on it this morning. But we got you here at 720 WGN. Stay with us.
I'm friends with the monster.
Oh, he's a monster.
I'm sitting there tweeting.
Monster.
Big, big, big tweeting.
Monster. I love you. It's a guy, but I love you.
Chuck Todd joins us. Chuck Todd, of course, the host of Meet the Press, joins us here on the Steve Cochran Show every Thursday. A huge week. I thought last week was huge. Chuck, when did you interview Omarosa? That was, what, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago?
That's amazing. 2 Sundays ago now. Yeah, I know. It's something else. There was
there was a timeline the other day. It was something that somebody was noting. Scott Pruitt. Do you know that only happened in July? He only quit in July. That feels like 6 months ago.
That feels like
the
2 years
Scott
ago.
The whole Scott Pruitt EPA, yeah, right. EPA controversy.
Well, of course, the news yesterday overshadows a lot of the recent news. The two guilty, I guess you'd say, the conviction of Paul Manafort, but also the guilty plea of Michael Cohen. Today, the president, you know, whether it be Fox News or Twitter, seems to think that this information exonerates him, or at least clears him of any wrongdoing. Where are we? I mean, is there? How do you sort of express the pressure that this puts on the president?
Well, look, I think the president is showing the pressure. I mean, he's very defensive. This Fox interview, he's already almost, he's engaging almost more in impeachment than others, and talking about how somehow the economy will collapse if he's impeached. So I think you see a president who's rattled. I think Michael Cohen has rattled him. Less the Paul Manafort. I mean, I think the Paul Manafort conviction was a blow to the campaign that Trump and Giuliani have been running against Mueller probe, right? Trying to raise doubt about it, and because Mueller won the Manafort probe, I think that set that back. But Cohen knows stuff. Cohen knows a lot of secrets. And I think the Cohen is what's got him so rattled.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, because we talked about it yesterday on this program, and it's talked about today. Politically, the fallout seems to be, you know, that it favors Democrats, but there's been a lot of concern and hesitation about throwing around the I word, the impeachment word, as this investigation is ongoing. Do you feel that as well? Do you feel that members of the Democratic Party are expressing some hesitancy when it comes to talking about this?
They are. I mean, they don't want to look like all they want. They don't. There is a fear among a lot of Democratic campaigns. Forget the leadership. It's almost more coming from the campaigns themselves, which is the voters don't want to hear about impeachment. Voters may not like President Trump. They may be upset about him in some parts of the country. But they're upset about health care. They're upset about the taint of corruption. They're upset about sort of in some places, the tariff issue and things like that. And so I do think some Democrats are worried that if they look like they're just making this a referendum on impeachment, that it could embolden Trump supporters, or it could harden some right-leaning independents who say, you know what, I'm not happy with the president, but I don't want to go through 2 years of impeachment. You know, there is this Trump fatigue that's out there, sort of Trump scandal fatigue. And I still think it's more of a problem for Republican turnout than it is for Democrats. But I think it's something Democrats have to worry about as they pound the president, pound him on issues. I think that's what voters want to hear more about rather than the scandals.
Chuck, you referenced the secrets that Cohen has on him and the stuff. How valuable is that information when the credibility of the person that has that information is in question?
Look, in all whistleblower, or this isn't a whistleblower, I guess you'd call this more RICO case. You're going to have some shady witnesses. I think Cohen's word is not as good as the information he can produce. You know, that's what makes his guilty plea on the campaign finance and him just saying that the president directed him. It's not just Michael Cohen's word. You know, he's got actual physical evidence that back him up. So what the threat that Cohen makes is not his word, it's the physical materials.
Right. Chuck, I'm interested, you know, because there's really two cases. There's the case of collusion, which, is one that gets thrown around and parsed out what that word mm-hmm. actually means. But then there's also the obstruction of justice. And we have seen a president and his administration get caught up in their own lies in the way, whether it be mm-hmm. on Twitter or other places where they said, oh, we never paid any money to mm-hmm. Stormy Daniels. Now it's out that they did. Never did this. We never met with anyone in the Trump Tower. Now it's out, they did. Does the case start to mount as more of these outright lies, public lies, get undermined? Does the case become bigger for obstruction of justice?
I think the obstruction case has always been, only gets stronger as the evidence of the conspiracy itself gets stronger, you know, because then obviously you get more of a motive for the obstruction. As it becomes more obvious, obstruction cases to me are, and I think especially when you're, you know, the whole obstruction case is not one you would fight in a courtroom. You'd fight it essentially in the well of the U.S. Congress. So it's it's more of a public opinion fight. So I think in that sense, I think it's when the actual conspiracy charge seems stronger that the obstruction case seems wider. Look, I actually think all of these cases are going to run into each other, not in that they're connected financially, but that they're connected, that they will look familiar. How the president and Michael Cohen and National Enquirer conspired to catch and kill potential, you know, Trump paramours or rumors about Trump. It's actually going to be similar in how he dealt internationally, potentially. I think that I would just say this. I know that there are a lot of people that call these investigations seem also separate, but you're going to see some connectivity in how they moved money around. And I think that's what's most lethal to the president right at some point. It's when you see the Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal pattern show up in other aspects of the Mueller investigation.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about public perception and how many voters on either side of the aisle would have less interest in this investigation about Russia, but more about how policies affect their everyday life. And we get a lot of people who will call in or text in who say, I don't care about this. The economy's doing well. I just care about jobs, whatever it might be. The question is, as more and more of these stories come out and more the undermining of what the president has said in the past, meaning his credibility or his, you know, obviously we're seeing a historic amount of lying that's being done. Do you see any evidence of that eroding public confidence in the president? Like, for instance, I personally just think that the idea that he went out so strong and said, I did not do this, and then now he did do it. Does that at all have any, does that resonate at all to the public?
I don't know. This is a question that I think a lot of us are trying to figure out. You know, one of the explanations for why Bill Clinton, why the public didn't hold Bill Clinton accountable, or on Monica Lewinsky front, right? Why didn't they go along with the idea of kicking him out of office? They knew before they elected him that he was messing around, that he wasn't a faithful guy, that he may have been morally compromised when it came to his personal life. But they made that deal, and they voted for him anyway. And that's the thing with Trump. It's not as if he was known as a truth teller.
Right.
Okay. He was known as basically a snake oil salesman, and to be on the negative side, or overly zealous salesman, if you want to be on the more positive side. But he always felt as if he was selling a bill of goods. Even people that liked him would say, yeah, I know he kind of BS's sometimes here and there. So that's a question I have. Is it already baked in? And does that mean that when he gets caught lying, people shrug their shoulders and say, oh, that's what I voted for. That's I knew what I was going to get. That's the part of this I'm not sure. Or is there a breaking point for some voters who are going, you know what? At some point, the president of the United States has to be a role model for at least average citizenship and an average moral compass of lying versus not lying.
I know people that have voted for him that say to me that they didn't expect him to be as presidential because he's a businessman. You know, he didn't come up in a political system. Mm-hmm. So when he's got these things going on, they're not surprised, like you said, just like Bill Clinton. He ran
in an erratic fashion,
yeah.
Right? So voters knew what they were buying. It isn't like he said he's not acting any differently than he did on the campaign trail. And that's always been, I thought, why his voters don't leave him. When people try to wonder, I don't understand why they tolerate this. They made the decision during the campaign to tolerate it.
Yeah. Great insight. Chuck Todd, the host of Meet the Press, joins us here on the Cochran Show on Thursdays. Chuck, what's on the show this week?
Oh, man. I am trying to put this puzzle piece together. It's going to be on the fallout of all this. It's a one topic show, but it's an existential crisis to the president. The midterm elections around the corner, all of this coming to a head.
Well, great work as always.
But putting the puzzle pieces together is going to be interesting. Who wants to talk and who doesn't this week?
Chuck Todd, thanks, bud.
You got it.
There you go. Chuck Todd. His show on Omarosa was tremendous.
Yeah.
For him to be able to extract the information out of her and be able to play the tapes, the exclusive tapes at the moment, and then push back on her and her credibility at the same time, I thought was really great as a journalist and a host to be able to play both in one interview. I thought that was exceptional. Chuck Todd joins us on Thursdays here on The Cochran Show.
The Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Got a boy back home in Michigan, and it tastes like Jack when I'm kissing him. So I told him that I never really liked his friends. Now he's gone and he's calling me a bitch again. There's a guy that lives in the Garden State, and he told me that we'd make it till we graduate. So I told him that the music would be worth the wait, but he wants me in the kitchen with a dinner plate. I believe
720 WGN is Steve Cochran Show. Steve's out, stepping up for Steve today. Justin Kaufman, the whole gang is here. Dave Bennett, Mary Sandberg, Mary Vanderbilt, Steve Grzanich. Lots to do here before 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200 is the phone number here on 720 WGN. Well, our next guest is jumping into the fray to become, and you know, it's fun because I've had Amara Enya on our programs here at WGN for a couple of years now, and I would always say she's an activist, she's an advocate, she's an educator, and she's a former mayoral candidate. Now I can't say that because you're a current mayoral candidate. Amara Enya is jumping into the race for Chicago mayor. She has run before. She ran in 2015, and she is getting back into it. She's got a big event next week, and she joins us in studio now to talk about it. Amara, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. I'm loving the new digs.
You like this?
New to me, yeah.
That's right. So, I guess that, you know, as you kind of grapple with what the first question would be for a mayoral candidate for the city of Chicago, but I guess it always goes back to, why would you want the job? What is it about this job that you're interested in?
Well, I'm a problem solver. I've always been a problem solver. I've always been involved in public life and really looking at challenges. And in Chicago, there are some significant challenges, but I see those as also opportunities to create the kind of city that we want. And so to me, undertaking that is a very worthwhile endeavor because people's lives depend on it.
How has your position changed on wanting to do it from when you ran in 2015 to doing it this year?
Well, so my position has actually been the same. It's just that the problems have gotten a little bit more, a little bit bigger, a little bit more significant when we look across the board on any issue. And so the things that we were saying 4 years ago have only been affirmed. And so it means that we have even more reason to make a pretty significant change in direction in the city.
I want to get your take on some of the issues that are that we face in the city of Chicago, and we'll get to that. But politically, you know, last time you ran in a way that you got a lot of great coverage as a progressive who was running at a time even before the sort of progressive wave that we've seen. Yeah. But at the same time, you kind of got jostled around in the ballot. You got bounced off at a certain point by some shenanigans and some political heavyweights that were moving money here and there. So what have you learned from the last time? What makes you a better candidate in 2018, 2019 than you were in 2015?
Well, there were definitely some hard lessons learned just in terms of what it takes to win. One of the things that set our campaign apart the first time was that it was really a movement across the city. It was incredibly diverse, and there was an energy behind it. And even as a first-time candidate, the groundswell of support that we had was really unprecedented, in my opinion. But there are realities related to fundraising, related to getting on the ballot. In Chicago, politics is not for the faint of heart. And so we did get some jostling and some elbowing. What that means for me is that we come back wiser, we come back stronger. The thing that is consistent is that we still have that groundswell of support, that people are really behind it. And I think that is what will be the foundation for a successful run this time.
Now, you know, it was interesting because early in that race, there was no progressive. It moved on. Chuy Garcia came in and forced the mayor, the incumbent, to a runoff. And since that time, we have seen much more of a groundswell of progressive Democrats who want to run for office. This race is crowded. There are several candidates already that would want to grab the mantle of the progressive Democrat. You have been in in that form of politics here in Chicago? How do you set yourself apart from the other candidates that are running on that same platform?
Well, in two key ways. One is actually having a track record of progressive politics that preceded running for mayor. So if you look back into my record and the work that I've done in communities, the alliances that I've had in those progressive spaces, it's something that preceded either of my runs for mayor. And so it's very authentic. The other thing is that looking at who is supporting the candidate. So again, for me, it's important to show that this isn't just about one person who decides that they want a job. This is about someone emerging from a movement of people who've been pushing on progressive issues for years. And so it's not a reinventing or creating a persona because you're running for office. It's simply already having the track record and then having the groundswell of support already behind you that supports that track record.
So I know you are interested in doing things differently than the Chicago way, but you probably really had to educate yourself on what the Chicago way is so that you can strategize against it.
Yes.
Did that help you in 2015 get you ready for this, deciding if you were going to do it again?
It did. So my education on the Chicago way started when I was working in government. So I've worked in government in the city of Chicago in the mayor's office, and that was a crash course in the Chicago way in a very deep way. But also I have this perspective of also working at the grassroots level. So I'm one of the few people who goes from the top level of government to the grassroots, and being connected to the issues on the ground is what supports my effort to say the Chicago way has to be different, because you're seeing that disconnect between the decision makers and those who are affected by those decisions. And so for me, a lot of people are saying something has got to give, because they haven't seen any of the promises made, they've not come to fruition. And after 8 years under this administration, at least, they're saying it's time for something different. We have to break out of the status quo because it's not working for far too many.
What do you think this race is about? What do you think that the race for mayor in 2019 is really about?
From my perspective, the 2019 race is a pivotal moment actually in Chicago's history. It is the point at which we can determine the direction that we want to go as a city. There's so many things that are at stake. So if we look at all of the different issues as it relates to policy, but it's about what kind of philosophy undergirds this city. And so we have an opportunity to really determine what that looks like. We don't have to be afraid of challenging systems the way they are. We don't have to be afraid of speaking out for things that we believe in. This is going to be an election about values. And I think that's why having a track record that reflects those values is going to be important. And also having people that say, this is the person that reflects the values mm-hmm. that we have. And so we're supporting that person. That's why that's going to be important, because it's going to be about the people saying, this is who we want.
Is there an issue that the city faces that is bigger than the others? I mean, is there something in your eyes as someone who is a Chicago resident and someone who wants to run for mayor where you say, this is really where we need to change?
Well, there are several. I think we have to be firing on all cylinders. This is the sort of thing where we have to multitask. So the big headlines right now are around violence. This has been a problem for years. To me, it is not an unsolvable problem. I don't think we have any unsolvable problems, but we have to have the will to actually address the root causes. The city's fiscal circumstances, that's a huge issue that's never really been addressed. We haven't had any real solutions, but we've gotten sort of platitudes about how we're addressing it, but not in real ways. Education is a huge issue. I mean, you can go down the list of the issues that we've seen in CPS related to its administration, to whether it's the sexual assault, mm-hmm. An abuse scandal, the closing of schools, all of those things, and the economy. What does it look like to have a growth economy that is inclusive, where it actually benefits existing residents in Chicago?
That's a very big point. I think it'll be played out in this mayoral race is about the economy, because the mayor will run, the incumbent will run on the fact that he has brought business and a surging economy to Chicago. But as you mentioned the word inclusive, at the same time, and on if on one hand you're going to talk about that, the other hand is that there are record numbers of people leaving the city of Chicago. Precisely. So how do you see that issue playing out in this race, and what are some of your ideas to make this to find that balance?
Well, it's one is just stating the facts of what is happening in the city. So if we look at the job numbers and who's actually getting access to jobs, we'll find that folks who actually live in the city are not the major beneficiaries of the jobs that have been created. If you look at what has been happening in terms of bringing businesses, yes, we've brought some major headquarters, but I work in the small business community. I do this work at the city level, at the state level, and I know the complaints and the issues that small business owners are having in and trying to stay afloat in this city. So what are we doing for the small businesses? Also, if you look at the disparity in investment, so we talk about 100 cranes in the sky downtown, but if you go just a couple of miles out into the neighborhoods, you'll see that there's not a lot of development going on. There have been some efforts in the last year or so, but those are politically motivated. That disparity in investment is really driving a lot of people to move out of the city for opportunities elsewhere.
So how, it's not a secret, the mayor and the governor don't see eye to eye on a lot of things. Do you feel like you could work with the governor, that the current governor, on...
Well, I could. In the latest example, so I had actually some legislation that was related to the small business community, removing some barriers for small businesses in Chicago, but it was actually statewide legislation. And so I initiated that, worked bipartisan in Springfield, and got legislators from both sides of the aisle to agree on this legislation. And the governor actually passed it. This is just a few weeks ago. So I think that is the kind of moving away from politics, or not letting politics interfere with being able to get things done. And so I've been able to do it. So I suspect that I'd be able to continue doing that.
More with Amara Enya. She is a candidate for Chicago mayor. She's having her big announcement at the Co-Prosperity Sphere down at 3219 South Morgan Street coming up here on Tuesday night. We'll talk more about that and also get Eric Edelstein in the mix and do our most valuable person on the planet, which is up next.
This is the Steve Cochran Show
on 720 WGN.
720 WGN, Justin Coffin stepping up for Steve today. He's back tomorrow. Amara Enya, mayoral candidate in studio. She'll be with us for the hour here. Eric Edelstein's going to join us as well. We'll talk a little bit national politics as well. But before we do that, the most valuable person on the planet for today, Thursday, August 23rd, I think it has to be Lauren Paris, who is blowing up the internet right now. Lauren wrote the song to adopt a cat, Bruno, who's known as the Thick Cat, a 25-pound rescue, who has grabbed everybody's attention because of his size. And then Lauren has wanted to adopt a cat and put together a little ditty for that reason.
Okay, now that's a cat.
Bruno was the Thick Cat, was surrendered to Right Way, a shelter in southern Illinois, and everybody wants to adopt this cat because it has become a sensation because of its size. And joining us on the line now, Lauren Paris, who is our MVPP for her creative way of trying to get our guy Bruno. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
I am so honored. Thanks for having me.
So what is it about Bruno? What was it about Bruno that that grabbed your attention?
Absolutely. So I saw him, it's been a week now, 7 whole days since I first saw his photos online. Just the initial post that Right Way Rescue had set up was starting to go viral. So a few friends had shared it. It's these two pictures of him side by side. I was sitting at my desk and I erupted. If you've seen these pictures, you know, you can just tell this cat is so special and gorgeous. And I said to my coworkers, I was like, I will stop at nothing. I'm getting this cat. I was so, it's kind of embarrassing how much ambition I had to get the cat, but I did, and it worked.
So Lauren, for the listeners who haven't seen the photos, Bruno stands on his hind legs and he has a big, I guess like a beer gut. I don't know how.
Yeah.
And he has these giant paws. And they rest on his sides, and so he doesn't, like, stand on four legs like a regular cat.
You know, sometimes he does stand on four legs. I honestly was a bit confused at first. I thought he was walking through life on two legs. It's not every moment on two legs. But he does do that specifically when he wants food. Last night was the first time we saw him just do it. I was making chicken enchiladas. I pulled them out of the oven, and my boyfriend gasped. And I was like, what? Did I spill? And Bruno had just stood up right behind me. He saw the chicken enchiladas. He saw something he wanted, and that was his way of letting us know.
Well, what was it about the, you know, you can go to the shelter and adopt a cat. Obviously, this cat is a viral sensation. But what was it that moved you to write a song to get the attention of Right Way?
Well, I want to make a really important clarification. I did not write the song. My really good friend, Second City's Kathleen Gibson, she wrote us the song. I knew, like I said, when I saw the photos last week, it was already kind of going viral. So I knew we have to stand out. And I thought, okay, well, it says Bruno is extra on the post. I'm like, well, I'm pretty extra, so this should be easy. I'm going to write a letter of intent. I'm going to get letters of recommendation. We're going to make a video tour of our apartment and of interviews with me and my boyfriend. And then we had a friend suggest, hey, why don't you have Kathleen write a song? Before I could even reach out to Kathleen, she texted me and said, I've already started. It'll be to you in an hour. She sent it to me, and it was perfect.
Now, Lauren, you said Bruno is extra. I know we read in the post that he likes to eat in one room, but he will drink water in another room. He doesn't want to drink water next to his food. Have you set it up that way for him?
We've set it up exactly that way. His food's in the kitchen, but he has water in his bedroom, in our bedroom, and in the living room, just the way he likes it.
Well, that's great. Lauren Paris, the adopter of Bruno the Fat Cat, which a song was written by her friend Kathleen, who to get the adoption for this viral sensation that is Bruno because of both his size and the way that he stands. Lauren, you're our most valuable person on the planet for Thursday, August 23rd. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
That feels wild. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That's great. Lauren and Bruno. All right, we'll take a quick break, come back here, and we'll do more with Amara Enya and Eric Adelstein will join us as well here in Steve Cochran's show, 720 WGN.
From the Allstate Skyline Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on WGN Radio.
All the boats I missed, all the hell I've caused.
720 WGN, Steve Cochran Show. Stepping up for Steve today. Justin Kaufman, the whole gang is here. 312-981-7200. Steve's back tomorrow. We're very excited to have him back in the studio running ship. Right now we're talking with Amara Enya. Amara Enya is throwing her hat in the ring for mayor of Chicago. This will be the second time she ran back in 2015. Had a lot of buzz for that campaign. It was a progressive campaign, progressive Democrat campaign. And we were kind of talking right before the break, this idea that progressive politics has gone from what once was the fringe to a little bit more mainstream. There are three or four candidates that consider themselves progressive Democrats that are in this race already. Do you see it that way? Do you see it that there has been a change in the way that that politics play in the city of Chicago, and that there is more of a mainstream approach to what was once considered progressive?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think one is that it has definitely moved into the mainstream, but I think that's also caused it to become a thing where people want to sort of attach themselves to the identity. I can recall in the early years, especially 4 years ago when I ran the first time, being a progressive was not something that I ever pronounced or said, hey, I'm a progressive. It was actually based upon the things that I had worked on in communities and in government that reflected a certain set of values about equity, about justice, about a city that works for everyone. And then it was, well, those things are progressive. Okay, fine. What we're seeing now is that the notion of being a progressive has moved into the mainstream, people are wanting to attach themselves to that. And in many instances, without having a real understanding of what the policies behind that look like. And so I always say it's going to depend on the track record. Being able to see what people have done that reflect so-called progressive values and using that as the basis to determine what's progressive and what mm-hmm. isn't.
Now, the mayor, the incumbent, and mayors before him, one that comes, who spent 25 years in office, Mayor Daley, they figured out how to win elections in Chicago. And, you know, you can take what you will from that, but really it's a strategy. They know exactly who to target. Data has gone come a long way in terms of politics. They know who's going to vote for them and who's not. There's a strategy to winning. What's your strategy? Who needs to vote for Amara Enya to win in February?
Well, so there's definitely the science behind targeting those voters, those likely voters. One thing that I think we should talk about is the fact that in the last election, it was 30% of eligible voters that voted. And so what that means is that there's a whole universe of folks who didn't even bother to vote. And so the strategy for us is recognizing who the likely voters are and a message that actually resonates with them. But it is also about expanding the voter base. And that means that you have to be the kind of candidate, the kind of campaign that is attractive to people of all different backgrounds, not just those who are likely to vote. But we actually believe fundamentally that we have to expand the voter base. We have to get more people actually bothering to vote in this city. And there's 70% of eligible eligible voters that we haven't really made any effort to attract. And so we, our strategy is not just focusing on the likely, but also engaging the folks who've been ignored and who've been left out of the process.
Well, Chicago is a very segregated city, and it's one that even in its politics votes that we like to break it down by ethnic blocks, right? I mean, we've been doing this for years where who is the black community, who are they going to vote for, a gay community, who they're going to vote for, lakefront liberals, so on and so forth. You know, for you, where do you see your block? I mean, as an African-American woman, do you say, okay, I'm going to try to court the African-American vote, or are you at the point in politics where you say, I'm not, that's not my approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was evidenced in the first run. Really, my campaign and message really superseding the typical identity politics. And part of that is because we have to look at the city as a whole and what it takes to have a city that works for everyone. And so the first time around, we weren't pigeonholed as the black candidate or the millennial candidate or whatever. It was, this is someone whose message supersedes all of that. As a person, being a black woman, living on the West Side, having worked in government, having worked at the grassroots level, working in the business community, there's being the from a family of immigrants. There's so many different identities that I could attach, but I think that's all the more reason why the message reflects all of what the city can be. And I think that's what will attract people as opposed to sort of balkanizing ourselves by one particular group or another.
Mara Enya is running for mayor of Chicago. She's having her big announcement party, her campaign launch at the Co-Prosperity Sphere, 3219 South Morgan Street in Bridgeport, coming up on Tuesday night. Yep. Find that online. Eric Edelstein joins us every Thursday, a Democrat consultant and political consultant who usually is joined with Pat Brady, but today solo as Pat is heading out west. Good to see you, bud.
Good to be here.
So listening to Amara, who's jumping into the race, I mean, the politics is all about data today, running campaigns. Do you have to have a certain strategy to get a certain voter to come out?
Well, strategy matters, but message matters more, I think. What you say, how you resonate, how you connect with people, saying things that are relevant to their lives. I mean, one of the reasons, as Amara said, that huge numbers of people don't participate is they don't think it matters. And I think it's incumbent on anyone running for office to have a message that empowers people and tells them why the election matters. Whether they're voting for that candidate or not, participation is something that it's corrosive when people don't. So, yes, obviously strategy matters. Tactics, how you put together data and put together coalitions, but I'm of the mindset that message trumps everything.
Eric, you've been doing this for a long time. We have issues like violence in this town. We talked a little bit about fiscal spend, the economy. More often than not, candidates will not go there. They won't go and say, this is what I'm going to do to fix this issue. I'm going to get in office. This is what I'm going to do.
Right.
They've decided, and we see this kind of playing out in the gubernatorial race, where it's more of you want me, not him.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Right.
Are we moving to more of a cult of personality where it's just about who do you like better as a popularity contest as opposed to any candidate putting out specific ideas for
well, I don't know that, things? I mean, I don't know that we're moving to it. I think there's always been that. I mean, it's sort of goes to human psychology, how we make decisions, all that kind of sociological stuff. And, you know, we don't pick spouses or homes or careers or movies or books based on logic necessarily. There's an emotional component. There's a human component in how you connect. You don't say, who's your favorite character in literature? Well, it's Madame Bovary because she makes really cogent arguments that hold water and substantively I agree with her ideologically. You say, wow, she's a leader or I trust her or she reminds me of my hero or something like that. So I never denigrate the notion that personality and human. Now, having said that, of course, issues matter and substance matters. And we are in a moment where everyone's got a camera. Everyone's got a recorder at all times. So, you know, there's a concern that if you're too far out there on one issue or too far out there on something, that's going to become fodder for your opponent. So I do think that creates a certain sanitized politics, which is too bad.
All right, Amara, I asked you to put your pundit hat on. We'll talk a little Democrat politics here. You know, let's why don't we start with the national story? And I also want to get to some of the state as we the gubernatorial campaign is in high gear now. But we saw yesterday two big stories with the Manafort verdict and the plea from Michael Cohen, the president on Fox News saying this doesn't really affect him in front of rallies and of course on Twitter. the Pat Brady on yesterday, there seems to be a rising sentiment or storyline that this is really an issue for the Democrats, and if they want to start using the I word, they're going to be in trouble. So we're talking about impeachment. How do you see it as Democrats, how you approach this investigation and this continuing controversy?
Well, first of all, anybody who's gleeful at what happened to Michael Cohen and Manafort and Trump and the president should not be. It's not a good situation. It's not a good situation for the president. It's not a good situation for the country. So you have to, I think, kind of separate the partisanship from what's actually going on. And what's going on is sad. And it is a sad state of affairs. And anybody who wishes for impeachment or wants it, I think, is misguided. Having said that, you know, look, here's the problem, fundamental problem the Republicans have going into the midterms. In 2016, depending on which poll you look at, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton among independents by 6 to 8 points. Today, generic congressional Republican versus generic congressional Democrat, independents are choosing the Democrat by 20 plus points. We are a pendulum nation. It isn't just about bases. Yes, the Democratic base is more fired up than the Republican base, but it's about those independent voters. And if those independent voters are swinging that hard to Democrats sitting here in late August, Republicans have a fundamental problem. And the only way they can undo that is either go get those independents back, which they don't seem like they're coming back, or fire up their base and get more Republicans to come out.
Are Democrats, Amara, are they going for that small percentage of that independent vote coming up here in the midterm? Is that why they want to avoid the idea of talking about impeachment?
Well, I mean, I think that they are. I think that they're definitely wanting to use this as an opportunity to get to create more energy. And in fact, they're here in Chicago this week, really talking about internally how they're going to leverage this to create this blue wave. I think that what would be instructive is for Democrats not to focus on the impeachment piece, because one of the problems has been, what is your message besides just how horrendous President Trump has been, or that you are not, that you're against Trump, and constructing a message that's actually very proactive that can win people to the Democratic Party. And so I'm hoping that they concentrate on that as opposed to on impeachment.
You know, when I just wonder, is it a foregone conclusion that Democrats will come out in November? I mean, are they're all energized and jacked up because of the way the president is acting?
Justin, did you pay attention to what happened in 2016? Are there really foregone conclusions in politics today?
Right.
There's no foregone conclusion. And look, the world changes in a moment. We all know that. I don't think anything is. I do think the wind is at Democrats' back right now, and Republicans, this only makes things harder for them. They have the real, again, if we're talking political tactics, they have the real problem, because there's this 25-30% of the Republican base that will, as Trump said, if I shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, they'll stick with me, sadly. And Republican candidates running need to hold on to that base, but they also need to appeal to those people who are disgusted by this president. So how you navigate that, I mean, that's just a jujitsu that, you know, will tie your mind up in knots. How do you appeal to those Trump loyalists on the Republican side and also appeal to those people who are disgusted by what's going on? That's why you're seeing these Republicans are running and ducking for cover. None of them are common. They're all, they've got this talking point of, well, I don't know enough.
Yeah, we can see how it plays
speculation
out.
And all that kind of stuff. But
the Democrats in Congress yesterday, some of the leadership as well as some of the rank and file, are talking about holding the confirmation for U.S. Supreme Court Justice or nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Do they have a point? I mean, this is a president who is under investigation, or is this just politics at play?
Well, I actually heard Schumer's statement yesterday. I thought it was actually one of his better statements. Look, you know, they're now trotting out these constitutional scholars on what the purpose of impeachment was, and you know, they're quoting George Mason and these guys that wrote impeachment. And the interesting thing is, one of the main drivers of the impeachment clause was if anyone corruptly attained the office of president. Now they meant it from the standpoint of if they bribed members of the Electoral College, or if they did something nefarious to get the office. Well, it's kind of the situation we're in right now. So if you're saying there was potentially Russian collusion, encouraging a foreign power to intervene in our election, if we're now saying he took an illegal contribution and covered it up. That's exactly what the framers were doing. So I think Democrats raising this at the legislative level is they're doing their job. I don't think they're playing politics.
When it comes to the SCOTUS pick, do they have a point to say, hey, let's hold this and see what happens?
I definitely think they have a point. I think they have a point if at no other time would they have a reason that's not just political, that there actually is some legitimacy to holding it up. I think this is that time. And so I think they're going to take that strategy. Probably also just thinking about the last time when they, under the Obama administration, when there was the hold up on his pick, and that was very politically motivated. I think this time they actually have a leg up because there is legitimacy to claims that are made about how he obtained the presidency and questions that are swirling around that.
Locally, let's talk about the gubernatorial race. Poll that came out yesterday showed J.B. Pritzker, the Democrat, up so 16 points or something on the incumbent, Bruce Rauner. Are you surprised by that, Eric, that poll? Because that seemed to be, I thought they were running closer, but this poll says absolutely not.
I mean, the polls I've seen have been in the lower double digits at this point. I mean, look, you've got a state where 70 to 80% of voters, Democrats and Republicans and independents, think the state's going in the wrong direction. You've got a governor who has no record or vision to run on, so his entire campaign is, I'm going to try to disqualify the opponent. I'm not surprised that Pritzker has a lead. I think Rauner's really flailing. That's why you're seeing him attacking everybody rather than kind of laying out his second term vision. So, you know, it's Pritzker's race to lose, and it's still a long way to go, but I'd sure rather be in his shoes than in Rauner's.
In terms of, it seems that Rauner's strategy is to go after House Speaker Mike Madigan and continue to hit that. You see that even in the Erica Herald ads for against Kwame Raoul. Do you think that's a winning strategy, Amara? I mean, I know that you may not be in step with the Democrats in the state of Illinois and Mike Madigan, but is it a winning strategy for Republicans?
I don't know that it's a winning strategy, but I do think it's an effective strategy. Again, people are articulating a dissatisfaction with the way the state's been going, not just over the last 4 years, but for years. And to be able to tie Speaker Madigan to all of the state's problems, I think, directs their ire to him, and by virtue of him, the entire Democratic Party. Right. And so I think that Rauner has found an effective strategy to use to blast the Speaker, but also to make the Democratic Party seem like the base or the core of the state's problems. And that's probably the best strategy that he has to win.
Erica, as we look to the next couple weeks in the gubernatorial race, but also in national politics, what do we need to be looking at? I mean, is it time for debates at the gubernatorial level and when in the midterm as well? I mean, is it just going to heat up? Are we going to have political story after political story until November?
Yeah, you know, historically, post-Labor Day is the official kickoff of campaigns, although we seem to live in the world of constant campaigns, virtual campaigns all the time. But I do think there's a bit of a mindset among voters, among media, even among campaigns, that okay, this thing's real now. We're done with the preliminaries. It's a sprint to Election Day. It's time to focus. Kids are going back to school. You know, we've got this thing coming up before Thanksgiving. I guess we got to pay attention to it. So, I do think you have a heating up of the rhetoric. You're going to see more ads. The debates will certainly start, and I think you'll see more and more people watching Netflix so that they can tune out the campaign commercials
until they figure out how to get those on Netflix.
That's right.
Eric Adelstein and Amara Enya. Amara Enya running for mayor of Chicago. She's having her campaign launch party at the Co-Prosperity Sphere, 3219 South Morgan Street in Bridgeport. You can find that information online. It's Tuesday night, and Eric Adelstein joins us Thursdays here on the program. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world,
some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you?
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, honey, you know I love you more than when I should. Yeah.
Cochran Show here at 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman stepping up for Steve, who will be back tomorrow, and they can continue the moron entertainment. I refuse to be given the high praise of being a moron.
Who does? Who takes a couple of days off and then comes back to work on Friday?
I know, right? She kept going. Dean Richards, heard every day on this program. Good to talk to you. How are you doing?
Delightful. I'm having a fun morning because we're showing old Muppet Show clips
today. Oh, wow, yeah.
kind of like a throwback Thursday, but that Muppet-like new movie, The Happy Time Murders, is opening tomorrow, which I'll tell you about tomorrow. But it's Muppet-like because, you know, it's puppets, number one. They kind of look like the Muppets. This whole movie is created and directed by Jim Henson's son, Brian Henson. So there is a very Muppet-like feel, except for the smoking, the swearing, the overly sexualized puppets, the porn-loving puppets.
Except all that.
Except all that. They're exactly like
it's
the
very
Muppets. It's an R-rated. It's not a Muppet movie.
It's not a Muppet movie, but everybody...
It's Muppet-like.
It's Muppet-like, but the thing is that, yeah, everyone thinks it's a Muppet franchise, right? Because it's the Muppets, right?
Yeah, it's Henson's names on it. Many of the old Henson puppeteers are even involved in it. But
I've always thought, Dean, that those two cranky old men puppets, they're Muppets,
the guys in the balcony,
could have had a side life that was maybe this Happy Murder Muppet movie, you know?
That they were murderers, you mean?
I don't know if I thought they were murderers, but I definitely thought they enjoyed a cocktail and things like that,
you
know?
They were very un-Muppet-like.
Yes.
What do you mean, like a side life? Like they opened a B&B in Saugatuck after... Like that kind of side life?
Something like that.
Is this like Avenue Q?
It's dirtier than Avenue. It's way dirtier.
Really?
It's way dirtier than Avenue Q. Yeah. I wanted to wear a rain slicker. It was like watching this movie is a little like going to a Gallagher concert.
What time of day?
Julio's taking his parents.
Yeah, what time of day, Dean, did you see that? Because that's like weird to see that content at a noon screening, you know?
Yeah, that would be weird. I saw it last night.
Oh, okay.
Saw it last night with an audience, which kind of made it even weirder.
It's going to be tough. I know.
Did you say Nick is taking his parents to see this?
Yeah, he's taking his parents, yeah.
They want to go see it. The dad did.
I have the issue where every time it shows, because it's Melissa McCarthy as well,
yep.
Miles... My 11-year-old son is like, the Muppets. We got to see that movie. And I'm like, we can't see that movie.
That happened with Ted in our house. Patrick wanted Ted, the talking bear.
Yeah, right.
He wanted to see that movie because the bear was so, you know, a compelling character. Yep. But can't go see that.
Yeah, this one is super R-rated.
Super R-rated.
Super R-rated.
That should be a new category.
Would this be the first Henson-inspired film that would be R-rated?
I believe so.
Yeah.
I don't think there's been one like this before.
Yeah.
I'm just so curious, you know, because Disney owns the Muppets now. The Jim Henson Company sold the rights to much of this to Disney, so they own it. So they're very careful not to do any sort of copyright infringements. They imply Muppety-like things, but they never cross over the line. And you never see Kermit or Piggy or the Swedish Chef or... All the old clips that I've been enjoying showing on TV this morning.
It's good stuff. The old Muppet show, the variety show they would do, is 10 seconds of air in the 70s and the 80s. That's a good. When you go back and watch that, that's some good
funny.
Stuff. Very
they
good
are funny.
Stuff.
It holds up.
This
comedy holds up completely. I don't know why. Let me ask you your favorite Muppets. My favorite in watching this, I don't know why, Swedish Chef. I'm dying laughing. I am on the floor laughing at the Swedish Chef.
You know what, Dean? My husband does the Swedish Chef a lot for the kids. It's also my favorite, too. Yeah. He flops his arms around like that.
Would Beaker, is it Beaker? Beaker be his, was that the Swedish Chef's partner?
No, he's the scientist.
Or that's the scientist partner.
The guy with no eyes, I think.
Yeah.
Beaker is another of the videos that we showed this morning was the Muppets doing Bohemian Rhapsody. And Beaker features prominently at that.
I love it. Dean Richards joining us here as he does every day at 8 o'clock. All right,
I get paid to do this.
You get paid to do
it. They paid me to do this.
We got some big news coming up on Ben Affleck. Also, of course, we talked a little bit about Big Bang Theory ending. Also, Aerosmith, Nicki Minaj. Some more news to get to as we do half of more on entertainment. With Dean Richards. Let's find out what's coming up in the 8:30 news.
I don't know why Justin is denying us.
I won't. Yeah, right.
We'll be calling his name. Oh, oh.
Dean Richards, the entertainment editor, Channel 9.
Dean Richards with us now here on 720 WGN. Ben Affleck, Big Bang Theory, Aerosmith, Nicki Minaj. These are big stories. Ben Affleck, let's start there. This is a story that I guess would be breaking. I was watching the E! News last night. I did not see any of this. So this is
it broke later in the evening, actually. And, you know, kind of, well, I guess it's great when somebody goes to get help. But Jennifer Garner, who's been split up from Ben Affleck, since 2015. They're legally still married, but they have been apart for all of these years. Staged an intervention for Ben Affleck. Went to his house in Pacific Palisades, California yesterday. Spent some time into the house. She came out of the house visibly shaken by the whole thing, according to witnesses who are there. But they both got into a car with another person and drove to a live-in rehab treatment facility in Malibu. And it's been confirmed that Ben Affleck is going to be staying there for a while and is seeking treatment for alcohol addiction. People close to him say that he knew that he was in need of help and that he has been very vocal about it. And it took Jennifer Garner to make it happen, to actually go over there and get him into the car and take him there. This is his third time now in rehab, so hopefully, you know, hopefully it sticks this time. It's tough.
Dean, I can't remember the details of the story. When they split in 2015, you know, like the nanny or drinking, I don't remember what was the main contributing factor. Was he just in rehab? Like, was he in a drinking phase then, or was he sober then?
Not when they split up in 2015. He was in rehab in 2001, and I don't even think he was with Jennifer Garner then.
Okay.
And then he
Jennifer Lopez.
He might have been. Been the Ben Affleck year.
Making that great movie that they did.
Oh, what was that called?
Jersey Girl or...
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember. I don't know why
I put that
out of my head.
Yeah.
anyway, he was also back in rehab just this past December of 2017. So I don't think alcohol was directly the cause of that. I'm not sure that they said specifically. They've been kind of quiet about all of that. I think it's interesting that they're still married after all of these
years.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
They never pulled the plug.
The movie is Geely.
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 Geely, yeah. Right. How could I forget?
That forgettable film.
Although I did.
I was watching the news last night, and that was all about how he had been all over Hollywood with a new woman, playmate.
A Playboy playmate. Yeah. And having their pictures all over the web of alcohol being delivered to his house, cases of alcohol being delivered to his house, which is it's just like the ultimate icky intrusion of a person's life when they're at a low point in their life. You know, somebody is camped out in front of his house taking pictures of everything that's happening so they can sell pictures of somebody who's at a low point in their life. That seems pretty...
Yeah, it's terrible. And entertainment news, you know, especially in some of the cable channels, is pretty flimsy. You know, they say sources close to the source. Right. And the Jennifer Garner quote last night, which I told my wife, I was like, that's the dumbest. But it was something. She's upon hearing about Ben Affleck and his new one, sources close to Jennifer say she's disappointed, but that's Ben being Ben. And I'm like, that's not the store. She went to his house. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And it's a source.
It's ridiculous.
Close to Jennifer. I mean, when you get that kind of attribution is shoddy, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree, man. It's terrible. All right, moving on. The big news as well announced that The Big Bang Theory is ending. 2019 will be the final year.
I'm sad about it.
12 seasons.
I want the show to go on forever. I'm a big fan of Big Bang Theory. I've always liked it. I think it's very funny. But I guess, you know, 12 years, that's a pretty long time. It is the longest running scripted multi-camera show in television history. So, and it's won 10 Emmy Awards through the years. But Jim Parsons apparently was about to leave. All of their contracts are about to expire. But Jim Parsons, who plays Sheldon on the show, has made no bones that when this contract was over, that he was going to call it quits, and the producers didn't want to continue without Sheldon on the show, so they have just decided to end it. Do you know that the actors make $1 million per episode?
Yeah. I believe it.
I remember when they got that.
$1 million per episode.
Do you think that's they'll keep
money.
Going with...
That's Steve Cochran money.
Will they keep going with Young Sheldon?
They are going to. Young Sheldon is a ratings hit and will definitely continue.
Well, I can't wait till the old Sheldon is released. Brown Sheldon. They're going to do Brown Sheldon, I heard.
Wrinkled Sheldon. Yeah, they're going to do all, it's like a whole menagerie of Sheldons. The final Big Bang Theory they say is going to be next May.
Next May. Another band that doesn't want Trump using their music, Aerosmith.
Aerosmith joins the list of... who's been on this now? It's been the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, Springsteen, I think, said
Springsteen, no. Springsteen has sent cease and desist letters to the president. Asking to stop using their music. Steven Tyler yesterday said that at the rally in West Virginia the other day, they were using the song Living on the Edge without permission and without payment, and that's illegal.
A weird choice for a song to play at a political rally.
Oh, you know, they're living on the edge there, I guess.
Wow.
So now it's the Stones, it's Neil Young, it's the group REM, it's Springsteen. If you got to play someone's music at a rally, you got to get their permission. And they also like to be paid for that sort of thing.
That's right. And finally, Nicki Minaj postponing her North American tour, including Chicago.
Yeah, this is the real reason Steve is off today. He just cannot
deal with it.
Steve, as you know, is regional vice president of the Nicki Minaj fan club. And just could not take the devastating news that she has postponed all of the dates on her North American tour. She was supposed to be at the United Center on September the 28th. That's not going to happen. None of the shows on the schedule are going to happen. They are saying, Minaj's camp, saying they're reevaluating elements of the show. Mm. Most other sources are saying it's because of disastrous ticket sales.
Really?
For example, the United Center, which seats like 17,000, they had sold about 3,500 tickets.
Oh, wow.
Which
wow.
is embarrassing.
And that is embarrassing.
Similarly, terrible ticket sales at every other major venue in the country.
So I like Nicki Minaj. I think she's great, and her new album is pretty good. So
did you buy a ticket?
I did not buy a ticket.
Okay,
but that's
there
the
you go.
I feel like overall...
You're the cause of this.
There is. They want hundreds of dollars for those tickets now. I'm not saying that that's the case with Nicki Minaj, but it's ridiculous to go to
expensive.
United Center. Yeah.
To go to a major
Soldier
concert.
Field or any of those...
It's ridiculous. And they keep, you know, and the shows never start on time. This is cranky old Uncle Dino. The show's not starting on time. I want to go home and go to sleep, and everybody should sit down too.
Dean Richards every day, 8 o'clock. Thanks, Dean.
See you guys.
So good. All right, coming up, Swap Meet with Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, and also Jason Benetti is going to join us. Talk White Sox, talk fallout for, I don't want to say fallout, I want to say maybe celebration of
aftermath.
The aftermath of the
reaction.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to give away a pair of tickets to the Chicago Blackhawks regular season home game.
What?
Purchase single game tickets at ChicagoBlackhawks.com.
Nice.
That's ChicagoBlackhawks.com.
I didn't know she had tickets.
I know. I've been
we'll do
keeping
that.
A secret.
All
so,
right. What
seventh
number?
Caller?
Seventh caller. 312-981-7200. Right now, regular season home game tickets. Seventh caller is going to get them. 312-981-7200. All right. We'll be back. Stay with us.
I now realize television has one major advantage over a live stage show.
Huh? What's that?
A television you can turn off.
Yeah, 720 WGN. Thanks, Steve. It's Steve Cochran's show. Stepping up for Steve today, Justin Kaufman. The whole gang is here. 312-981-7200 because it is time for the Swap Meet with Greg Flamm. Greg, of course, can be found at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Joins us here weekly on the Steve Cochran Show. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So we want to get into the show. We got a lot to talk about, of course, when it comes to memorabilia, sports, and otherwise. But what did you bring with us today?
Well, with Comic-Con this weekend, I brought my rare set of Doctor Who posters, and they were promoting a book back in 1986, so they're really rare.
I'm going to say you're a nerd, Greg.
I am not, but I love the nerd money. I love to make that nerd money. So I'm being dead honest. I once sold a Doctor Who poster for $350. Oh, I had 17 signatures on it from another Comic-Con.
Wizard World coming through this weekend. Yeah. Is that a good place for people to go to find memorabilia? And do you find a lot? For you personally as a picker, do you find things at the Comic-Cons that you wouldn't otherwise find?
You know, I would go, but personally, I won't buy there because everything is just so inflated because of the captive audience for that event. I just keep looking elsewhere, to be honest. Estate sales, garage sales, flea markets for right. that stuff. You'll find much better pricing.
Interesting. I always go there with Miles, and we'll go to the Wizard World or C2E2, and they're always hawking the kind of stuff they're finds and selling it.
Do you guys dress up, or what do you do?
We have in the past. Cool. Now at age 11, he's more like, you can check it out.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Okay, so the other big story this week, of course, Kopech Day. Mm-hmm. Michael Kopech made his debut on the mound, I think on Tuesday night. Okay, so I saw a couple of Michael Kopech jerseys.
Right.
People starting to get in. There was a lot of, if I was at that game, say I was, should I be keeping the cup and the nachos and the things that I ate?
I would keep anything that proved you were there. Ticket stub.
Like the ticket.
Yeah. Program, the score sheet.
Maybe what if you got free tickets from your office?
Well, if they had the date, you're good, maybe even buy two programs, keep scoring one, the other one keep blank, just anything that could prove that day. So, and I would think, his first full game hopefully goes really deep Sunday. I guess he's pitching. That'd be great, too.
Yeah, well, in 10 years, we'll be doing the swap meet here on WGN, and someone will call up and go, I was at Kopech Day.
Yeah, what's that jersey?
And you'll be like, 20, 30 bucks.
Yeah.
312-981-7200. Speaking of Kopech Day, Jason Benetti joins us. But before we do that...
Matt, what's the difference for you when you get a chance to play in the field like you did today as opposed to DH?
I feel like a baseball player. Interact with with the grass and the ball, and I get to use a mitt, a leather thing. So, it's pretty cool.
How do you interact with the grass?
Well, I try to get I try to do a little earthing when I get off the plane early here. If you come out about 1 o'clock every day, I'll be out barefoot. Getting my protons and neutrons in order. I'll see you tomorrow, Benetti.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
Jason Benetti joined us on the line as people line up for the swap meet. 312-981-7200. If you were at Kopech Day, maybe tell us what you got or any other sort of Sox memorabilia. Jason, one of your more hard-hitting interviews with Matt Davidson there about his relationship to the grass. But I would say one of the better interviews because it was fun to see your interaction with the players.
So here's the thing, actually. He is serious. He actually does earthing. I asked him the next day, I was like, you were joking, right? He goes, no, I learned with the Diamondbacks organization that to reintegrate yourself after you take a plane flight, you should do earthing. So what's amazing is that was actual information.
Wow. There you go. See, you get everything from a White Sox broadcast, right? Mm-hmm. Jason, we just were talking about White Sox memorabilia and Kopech Day, of course. Huge time at the park, and it was a playoff atmosphere on Tuesday. From your vantage point, being there and being a part of that, something good to look forward to.
Yeah, it was. First of all, for the swap meet, I saved my scorebook, which I'll be using again today, and my pens from that day. So maybe we can hawk those later.
That's awesome.
The thing that for me was so intriguing is he went out there and he said after the game that his lip was quivering some, and we had him on screen kind of doing the heart palpitation motion with his hand. He is as ready as somebody could be for this and cares so much about being a great one that he couldn't even fight off the butterflies that he had. And that's the best part of this game, is that it takes somebody who is pretty accomplished early in life, and it just changes them for one day, and it changes the people watching them, too. People are standing on every two-strike pitch. That's awesome to be around. I mean, just hanging on every pitch, and to know that that's not the only debut on its way for the Sox is a pretty invigorating feeling.
And I know, Jason, that it was different for you. You could hear it in your voice. And, I mean, it has to be. As a broadcaster, you look for those moments where there is something extra in the ballpark that night. Was your lip quivering at all before you went on camera with Stoney?
You know, no, in part because I've done this before slightly. In AAA, we had Steven Strasburg come through in 2010 when he was the next shiny pitcher in Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. And I did six of his starts, a couple of them on TV and a few on radio. And the first one, I was like, oh my goodness, this is a way different atmosphere than we've ever had. But about halfway through the game, I was like, okay, it's still about the game and the players. And so I've felt that emotion before. And for me, it was just cool to watch our fans get thrilled about it.
So for the fans listening, obviously they were excited about seeing Michael Kopech. Eloy Jimenez's name comes up, others as well. The rosters, of course, expand September 1st. Should we expect to see some of these phenoms or at least puzzle pieces to a future White Sox team brought up then?
Yeah, I think that's still being discussed. I really do. I'm not sure that there's been a full decision that's been made on that. And, you know, as we saw with Kopech, the 14 days prior to his arrival, Sox Twitter was kind of getting a little angsty about Kopech. He had seven great starts in a row. And then when that release happened in terms of the angst, I think there was sheer excitement. So for me, and it's always been the case, it's what I've said all year long and will continue to say, whenever the exciting players from the minor league get here, we will give them their due and we'll be thrilled by them. But for now, everybody that's here is a person that, you know, can have a big day and can be embraced. Like Daniel Palka, for example. I know he doesn't have the sexy name of Kopech or Eloy Jimenez. Daniel Palka's got 18 home runs in a year when we went to spring training, nobody knew his name in mainstream Sox culture. So I think that's the exciting part of going to the ballpark every day, is that a star can be born even if it doesn't have a star name.
And the surging Nicky Delmonico suddenly red hot on a power surge here, Jason. But I just one other note, Carlos Rodon, because with all the attention on Kopech, this guy has been, and I know he gave up a couple runs in the first inning yesterday, but over the last month and a half, I mean, he's been lights out for the White Sox.
Yeah, he looks like an ace, doesn't he? The stuff that he's provided his last couple starts, we didn't see it as much yesterday, but he's been throwing that slider inside to right-handed batters for years and years and years. Every now and then he buckles them with a slider away, and that adds to his ability to deceive. So I'm really excited about Rodon. The one thing I would suggest about his starts is if you have a little one that's maybe in the first 10 rows and you think Carlos about to throw ball four, I'd cover the little one's ears. Because Carlos gets pretty angry when he throws ball four. We heard it twice in the booth yesterday. There was it wasn't exactly the old Batman series. It wasn't pow or bang, but there was definitely an exclamation after ball four. So you can just see how ridiculously competitive the dude is.
You talked about Daniel Palka. He tweeted after that Matt Davidson interview that it was a Matty D with an elite interview. And he said, personally, I'm a fan of smelling and tasting the grass when we get it to the ball field. People say that's weird. Whatever, though, man. Chlorophyll tastes good. Chill.
The guy is insane. Daniel Palka, I don't know if you all have heard the story, but he's got this on Wikipedia for one of the McDonald's All-American games, I think it was 2011, I think his name is still listed on the page for that McDonald's All-American game basketball roster.
Really?
He added it himself. Tells this story about how last year in spring training, or 2 years ago, recently in spring training with Minnesota, he was talking to some guys that were watching basketball over a meal, and they're looking at the screen, and Daniel's like, oh yeah, I played in that game. And they bought it, and while they were buying his fake story, he went on Wikipedia and added his name. The guy is a treasure.
Oh, that's great.
That's great.
Jason Benetti, of course, the broadcaster for the Chicago White Sox, which you can also hear here on 720 WGN. Jason, thanks for taking the time. I would appreciate it.
Thank you, and I just want Dave to know I'm going to see the Cats in a couple weeks against Duke. So,
oh, excellent.
I look forward to that.
Oh, great. We'll have our usual pregame huddle.
Yeah. Yes, I'm excited. And picture, I hope.
I hope so.
There you go.
All right, see you.
Thanks, Jason.
Safe travels.
All right, there you go. Jason Benetti. Back to the swap meet coming up here. 312-94-994.
Get that nerd money.
Yeah, that's right. 312-981-7200 for the nerd money. The swap meet, of course, sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. All right, 312-981-7200. Steve Cochran Show here. Justin Kaufman. Greg Flamm is here at DuPage Picker. He joins us every Thursday. You can find him on Facebook and Twitter under that handle.
I like DuPage Twinder. Picker.
Twinder. You can find Greg on Twitter.
That's my new investment.
Yeah, Twinder. All right, so let's go to the line. We've got some people who've been standing by. Mike, why don't you start us off? What do you want to brag about, Mike?
My mom just showed me a ball that my dad had. It's an autographed ball by the White Sox, the 1951 team. And I looked at the names against the 51 roster, and it looks like it's got everybody's signature on it. Is that something special?
Yeah, I did find one that was sold recently for $325. But again, wow. We talked about team balls. They're more apt than not all real signatures. Some are auto-penned. But 1951, I would guess more than not.
Yeah, they weren't doing auto-pens yet.
Right. So I think you've got something good there.
Yeah, there's a couple nice names on there, like Minnie Minoso, and Nelson Fox, and so forth. So, okay, I'll tell her to take care of that thing.
Yeah, that's great.
Put it in one of those glass boxes, right?
Yep, for sure. Thanks for calling.
All right, let's go to Drew. Drew, what do you want to brag about, Drew?
Yeah, well, for just a little bit of background, in the 1970s, Disney re-released Fantasia in the theaters for the hippie crowd, let's say. And I've got an actual theater-hung poster. It's real psychedelic. It's got some creases in it, but it is authentic from the 1970s when they re-released it.
Wow.
That's right.
Cool.
Yeah, movie posters, there's a lot of money in those. And you got to pay close attention because they reproed those to make them look like the movie posters. Jaws is a big example of that. So many repros you have to look. But yeah, that's cool. I'm trying to get your price on that. But
so Fantasia came back out into the theaters. I always had a problem finding Fantasia. I wanted to show Fantasia to Miles when he was younger, and it was always hard to find that.
Well, because I don't think that they don't release them always. They don't have them on
Disney's
video.
Disney's the king of that.
Yeah, they wait, 25 years, and then they put it out.
Yeah.
Especially during the VHS days, they would do that, hold off and then put them out.
Right, so there you go. All right, we'll look for that, Drew. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. All right, let's see where they go. Also, this is a good one. 708 says, here's the pieces to the Budweiser sign that Kyle Schwarber broke.
Yeah, that's great.
How about that, Dave? You remember that?
Of course. Absolutely. In 2015.
So those pieces probably shattered, and Dave here is running around getting those pieces. How do you get that?
That's a great story. I mean, hopefully they can authenticate that somehow, because it would probably bring a nice chunk of change. It also reminds me of Mark McGuire hitting the TGIF Friday sign in Arizona, and they've immortalized that. I think they keep the neon off of that, and they have a nice plaque showing when he hit that home run. I guess I don't know if it was during batting practice or a real game.
I can't remember.
But
he hit the sign there.
But yeah, he hit the sign out there. So.
All right, we'll keep going here. They say our Hummel figurines, are they worth anything these days?
They can be. You have to, they're needle and haystack type stuff, but they can be a few hundred, 400 to 1,000, some of them.
Okay. Jeez.
Yep. There you go. And I have a concert black Led Zeppelin baseball hat.
Is that Wendy Snyder texting
that in? A Zofo and the three other signs under the name of the front of the hat. Very good condition. Are baseball hats like that, concert hats, worth it?
Yeah, if they're the authentic, like if it was from a 70s concert and you could prove it with a tag or whatever, that could bring probably 150 or more. So, you just got to make sure it's from the period. That happens a lot with the rock t-shirts as well. I mean, they can check the tags and just verify it that way.
And this one's for Dave. This is the final one here. Mm-hmm. I noticed this. I was going to talk to you about this at Kopech Day when I was at the game. I was surprised because I saw some Michael Kopech shirts kind of, just been made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I have seen an inordinate amount of Carlos Quentin jerseys. At the White Sox park.
Really?
Yeah, like that's number 20, Quentin. I saw four of them that night. That's the go-to. That must have been the go-to t-shirt at the time, the Carlos Quentin jersey.
Why that would be.
He was a cutie. Were these women wearing these jerseys? Because he was a nice looking
He did have
player.
A female following.
Yeah,
maybe that's it. It was mixed gender, so I don't know. But I saw a couple, but yeah.
Very interesting. Not a name that I would think in White Sox history. Nope. Like, oh yeah, what an era. But he, yeah, era. He's, there's a people must have, that must have been a big time to put to buy jerseys. Yeah, like, I guess I'll take Quentin.
Yeah, I was a big fan, and I was really disappointed when he smashed his hand. That was just he had a great year going.
Get us all mad, Greg.
I know.
Nerd money over here, being a downer.
Downer.
Greg Flamm can be found both on Facebook and Twitter with the handle DuPage Picker. He also is out at Wolf's Flea Market. It's a sponsor of this segment in Palatine every weekend. You'll be there this weekend?
Yep, every Saturday and Sunday, 8 to 4 p.m.
8 to 4 p.m. Greg Flamm back next week. Good to talk to you, buddy.
Thanks.
All right, let's do this. We'll take a break, come back, get the news. We'll welcome CLTV as well. And coming up, we're going to have the Chicago Afrobeat Project in studio. So lots to do still here on the Steve Cochran Show. Stay with us.
This is the Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm going to do. No, there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
720 WGN and CLTV. It's Steve Cochran Show. Stepping up for Steve today, Justin Kaufman, but Mary Sandberg, Dave Ennett, Steve Grisanich, Mary Vandeville. We're all here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to hear from Walter Jacobson. We got his perspective. And Chicago Afrobeat Project will be at Navy Pier tomorrow. 15-year anniversary for the Chicago Afrobeat Project. A great collaboration, band. I guess it's a band, but it's they collaborate different musicians from Chicago playing different types of music and genres, and we'll talk with them.
Collaborative performance.
There we go. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. Thank you, Mary. Mary and I, Dave as well, we had to had our emergency building training last week where we had to sit and learn about our building. What was the big takeaway for you, Dave?
Well, first of all, I'd say we didn't have to. We wanted to.
Oh, sorry.
I found it very interesting. I learned some things. I would always have assumed if there was a fire, you just find the nearest stairwell and head out of the building. But that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, there was a lot saying stay where you're at until you're told.
Yeah, stay until you're told.
Well, because the firefighters have to use the stairs for their setting up.
Right, and that there's two stairwells. Mm-hmm. I never knew that.
Yeah, right. So we learned a lot. We also learned about fire safety and fire sprinklers. That was a big part of it. I did not realize that the sprinklers will not go off when there is smoke. They will only go off when there's heat.
Yes. And I also learned that if I put my keys in a sock, I can use it as a weapon.
Okay.
Or your can of pop.
Yeah, right. Well, we wanted to continue the conversation about fire safety in Chicago with the Northern Illinois Fire Sprinkler Advisory Board and also someone from the Sprinkler Fitters Local 281. Tom Lee is with the advisory board, and Brian LaRoche is with the Sprinkler Fitters Local 281. He's also the apprentice training coordinator, and they're in studio. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Justin, Mary, and Dave. Appreciate it.
Did we take away the right stuff from fire safety? I mean, what I said about heat, and I mean, I got it.
No,
I'm ready
absolutely.
To go.
That's one of the big misnomers about fire sprinklers is that every movie, every cartoon that's out there, all the sprinklers go off when there's a fire or smoke or somebody burns toast.
Right.
It takes the actual heat of a fire to break the glass that holds the water back, and only the sprinkler that has the fire will operate. So that alone makes a big difference with the
people's
education.
Well, and I think because you said because of movies, but at home, because smoke will set off your alarm,
right?
You think that's going to trick off the water system as well.
They're interconnected, but they're basically two separate systems. So basically, when that head goes off, the only time you'll see a system that has multiple heads going off at one time is for a high hazard situation like an airplane hangar.
Interesting.
But in a retail or an office building, one head, most of the time, one or two heads will put that fire out.
96% of the time, correct.
You know, I would think, and you've seen a lot of this in the city, there will be calls where there will be smoke. I was actually in Washington yesterday where there was smoke billowing out of a window downtown. It seems to be because of fire technology, that we're talking about sprinklers, other things, that there's more of an opportunity to contain and get rid of that fire quickly from the fire department and from the building's inspection systems or sprinkler systems. We had a fire in the area within the last month or two, the Prospect, Prospect Heights fire. Where it wasn't. Tell us about this fire, because this is one that when I looked at it, I was like, well, that's so interesting that this building, it burned completely.
Sure. River Trails, I believe it was 96 units that were affected. Over 500 firefighters responded from 50 different fire departments. They had to move up. You know, the suburbs came in pretty deep with that one. They had to bring in a lot of support. They had no fire stops. They had no draft stops. Mm. They had a mansard roof, which comes along the side of the building. The fire was started by a young child. It's one of the problems we have, juvenile fire setting. And it's not, we're not going to blame that person, but it started there. It could have been contained if there was a sprinkler in that unit, but there wasn't. So basically, you had a small fire that was started in a unit. Once it got to the attic and the open areas, it just kept going. They couldn't stop it. There was nothing for the firefighters to make a stand. So once it got to a certain point, they kept moving, 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 trying to contain the fire. With no fire stops, no firewalls, the mansard roof.
Do we see this a lot in the Chicago area? I mean, is there a percentage or a number of, or just a ballpark figure about how many buildings are retrofitted and ready for, with the latest in fire technology as opposed to the ones that just don't have anything?
Well, at this time, California and Maryland have adopted codes where they require all new homes to be fire sprinkler protected. Illinois happens to have 104 communities that have adopted it, with Long Grove being the first one in 1988. Palatine recently just passed one last month, I believe. Hmm. And in the outer areas, Rock Island passed it.
So do you go back to retrofit other houses with
no,
that ordinance?
No, that's a good
passing?
Point, Mary. It's all new homes only. But towns like Clarendon Hills, LaGrange Park, and Park Ridge, they tear down a home. The new one has to be built with the new technology, whether it's the energy efficiency or the fire sprinklers that are in there.
And what about the city of Chicago? I mean, that obviously with such a residential width, if you will, does the city of Chicago have the same kind of ordinance in place?
I'm going to give them kudos for having, most of those single-family homes that are coming in right now are on 30-foot lots, so they're real narrow. So the architects and the people, they want to use all the space they can, but they have to have a second exit, a stairway. And the Chicago gives it an option. If you eliminate the second exit, you can put sprinklers in and you can remove the stairway. So there's at least 2,000 homes protected in Chicago that way. The high rises are a different situation. They did, after the Cook County Administration Building fire, they retrofit all the commercial buildings, which just ended in 2017. And they're still winding up with the residential high rises. However, Chicago went with they custom made a code which really doesn't follow any national standard. They tried to compromise, but I feel that the compromise
wasn't
enough.
And I've read about this. This is the idea that the older buildings, maybe they'll be historic in nature, or maybe they're just built differently, that there was a lot of exemptions made in the code to say, well, if you have an older building, you don't have to necessarily retrofit it because it costs too much money. And there was a lot of concern saying that's just a way for people not to spend extra money to get themselves up to speed.
Exactly. They did. That was a good point, because they would make a voice alarm enunciation in every building, which I think is a good idea. However, that's not going to stop a fire, and it's not going to notify you about a fire either. So they gave you points for that, and they reduced the points for fire sprinklers so that specifically your building could pass the life safety evaluation without putting them in. But right. I think it gives the people a little bit of a false sense of security, because out of maybe 1,000 buildings, I think 100 chose to pass their life safety evaluation with fire sprinklers.
And a texter put up a good point saying for single family homes, to fit them with sprinklers and the latest technology, there's a cost to that. That's cost prohibitive in some cases. Is that something that you're just going to have to live with? That's how houses are going to be built this way, and you're going to have to factor that into the price?
You have to consider that. That's very important. What you also do is that you get your insurance saving for your unit. But not only does your unit get the insurance saving, you can get the common area, so that the association and the people benefit from that. Factor those costs in, and then you can really get a hard figure on how it costs.
Brian, I'll give you the last word here, because with the union, there's a lot of opportunity here for employment, because as we're talking about retrofitting in new homes, there needs to be a skill associated to
Absolutely.
Putting these sprinklers in.
Yep. What we have is we have over 1,000 working members in Chicagoland that are out there every day installing, maintaining, inspecting, and testing sprinkler systems. So it's a great opportunity for young people, if they're looking for a skilled trade.
For you, as technology changes and sprinklers change, what do you have to do at the union to keep up with that, to make sure that everybody, not just the apprentices, are trained up, but that the trainers are trained?
We're constantly training and going and upgrading our skills. We just spent the last 9 days up in Ann Arbor, where the United Association, which is all the plumbers, sprinkler fitters, pipe fitters in the nation and in Canada, we go there and we upgrade our skills, and we become the students. The teachers become the students.
Where can we find out more information if I'm interested in getting into this business?
Basically, our website is www.sprinklerfitterchicago.org. and you can keep track. We're going to be taking applications for our apprenticeship program after the first of the year.
There you go. That is Brian LaRoche. He's with the Sprinkler Fitters Local 281. And Tom Lee is here as well, the Northern Illinois Fire Sprinkler Advisory Board. Guys, thanks for coming in and talking about fire safety. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having us.
This is the Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
720 WGN, Justin Kaufman stepping up for Steve. Steve is back tomorrow, 312-981-7200. Coming up at the 10 o'clock hour, Bill and Wendy take over here on 720 WGN. Well, this tomorrow night will be the last performance in the watercolors series at Navy Pier. It has been a series of jazz performances at Navy Pier, and it has been it's featured some great music. Lowdown Brass Band, which was performed live here on WGN, Marquise Hill as well, just played last week. Coming up tomorrow night is going to be Chicago Afrobeat Project, a great collaborative group that has been performing in Chicago for over 15 years, a tremendous group of musicians, and they're going to be on stage tomorrow at 6:30 at Navy Pier. And they're in studio with me today, as well as Daniel Crane, who is the Navy Pier Program Coordinator for this series. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks.
And I want to introduce some of the guys in the band: David Glines, Kevin Ford, also Rhea the Second, and Legit as well. Here, thanks to everyone for being here in Chicago Afrobeat Project.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so let's first start with, where does the impetus for this series come from? Because is it bringing jazz to Navy Pier? Navy Pier, known as it's a great tourist destination. You could put a cover, a classic rock cover band up there and be fine, I'm sure. What was it about bringing the jazz genre to Navy Pier?
Well, you know, Watercolors presented by CIBC. We started it last year, and as many people don't know, we opened up brand new performance locations. Polk Brothers Performance Lawns opened up last year in July. We have this really beautiful stage called the Lake Stage, Polk Brothers Park Lake
Stage.
And
a lot of this was because of the rehab, the renovation of Navy Pier.
Right, so Navy Pier is really dedicated to becoming a cultural destination and not just known as a tourist place. And so we have been kind of presenting a lot of different types of music, and since Chicago has such a rich history in jazz and such a diverse scene in jazz, you know, we thought it would be great if we teamed up with the Chicago Institute, a jazz institute, and kind of present a series, you know, for the city and for the tourists to come and enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, how much do you, is it specifically for tourists, or how much do you, is the combination of bringing actual Chicagoans to the pier to see some of these very specific, very good Chicago bands?
I think that we want, you know, we really want a mix of both. You know, I think it's great if a tourist stumbles upon Marquise Hill on the lake and they're like, who is this? You know, and I mean, he's touring the world right now. And then also Chicagoans to be like, wait, I don't go to Navy Pier. You know, that's like you said, there's cover bands and stuff like that. And it's like, no, we're actually presenting, you know, really high quality music on a stage where it's like when the night hits, you have like the boats lit up. It's really a beautiful, a beautiful scene. So we're really excited about having Afrobeat, you know, Chicago Afrobeat Project here on Friday.
Well, let's make that transition, talk to the members of the group. You guys have been around for 15 years. Just to give people an idea, because there's a lot of distinct jazz that's a part of this lineup. Afrobeat is a genre of music. David, take us through what Afrobeat is.
So Afrobeat began in the late 60s and early 70s in Lagos, Nigeria. Fela Kuti and Tony Allen. Tony Allen was his drummer. Fela Kuti was a vocalist, a band leader, and political activist in Nigeria, and created the style coming out of high life jazz that was a little more funk influenced. So the style typically is political in terms of its lyrics, or a political bent, huge horn sections, percussion, very danceable. And I think that one thing that we're doing is just adding a lot of Chicago angle to this style that's been around for decades.
Well, it's a style that you mentioned Fela Kuti. There's a lot of great Afrobeat musicians that, of course, come out of Africa, but also around this country as well in the United States. What is it about Chicago's Afrobeat sound that is distinct or differentiates itself from some of the other sounds from around the world?
Well, in our case, we're lucky to be in a city that has a lot of really good music and that has pushed, you know, envelopes in jazz and rock, you know, with like post-rock with Tortoise and some of the John McIntyre stuff, experimental jazz with Fred Anderson and that whole tradition. And so it's a very creatively liberated city musically, which is, it's exciting to be a musician here in any style of music. And as far as our particular band goes, I definitely think we incorporate the dance music tradition of Chicago. We're always trying to get people up and dancing. You know, house music came from Chicago. We have a little bit of that influence. But just, you know, soaking up everything in the city, all the creativity, it's just, it's like fuel for us, you know.
Let me bring in Rhea. For you, do you approach this band as a fan of Afrobeat and understanding the history of it, or is it more that it's a jazz group that, as was just mentioned, brings in dance beats? What drew you to this project?
Yeah, originally, just knowing Afrobeat music just from coming up and just being around it, I was definitely excited being a fan of the genre. But on top of that, like, I know the guys, you know, so just coming into it as like a friend but also a lover of the same music is kind of what ultimately brought me to wanting to be a part of the band.
And legit, I ask you the same question, just getting involved in this music, how much of it is you know, being a disciple of the genre as opposed to just finding good musicians in Chicago to play with?
I think it would probably be more of the latter, just going into it. I definitely had very limited knowledge of Afrobeat prior to working with this group, working with this project. So it's, but it's fun, though. It's, I love, like, just learning about new cultures, learning new music, and just experimenting.
And that's part of, I would assume as well, if I've heard from other musicians about Chicago, is the ability to blend genres or be able to have a focus or a, I guess a palette to start with and be able to add a bunch of different, you know, styles and influences into the mix.
Yeah, and I think Legit's situation, for example, is not uncommon with other musicians I've worked with in the group over the years. So people will be friends with somebody, will bring them into the group. They have deep experience in hip-hop or rock or some other genre, and all of a sudden now they're playing Afrobeat. And that's actually kind of what we've relished in this band for since the beginning, is we knew that everybody had different backgrounds. Maybe they weren't familiar with Afrobeat, but we knew that we wanted to use that as sort of a, you know, what we say, a springboard to explore all this other styles. Like, Afrobeat's always there, but really sometimes maybe there'll be, you know, there'll be a predominantly heavy hip-hop influence or jazz influence, more jazz influence.
For, you know, obviously for the opportunity to play at Navy Pier, to play to audiences who may not necessarily follow you guys or be specific loyal fans of the band, that's a great opportunity. But for fans who really want to see you in your element, where's the place to see Chicago Afrobeat Project in Chicago?
I would say after Navy Pier, this Monday night, we're actually playing a show featuring Tony Allen. Tony Allen is from Paris. He's the Fela Kuti's original drummer. We just put a record out with Tony last year called What Goes Up, recorded by Kevin over at Fullerton Recording Studios in Logan Square. And we're extremely excited about that show and Navy Pier. They're going to be slightly different shows. Navy Pier is free. At the Promontory on Monday night is where we're playing. That won't be free, but it's, again, featuring Tony, and it's going to be pretty...
How do you guys interact with the jazz community here? There's a lot of... You mentioned some great names, you know, Fred Anderson, and there's so many other great jazz artists in this town that have found a place in Chicago, even after the history that precedes it. Talk about, you know, how do you guys fit into the jazz community here in Chicago?
Well, I play jazz as well, and it is kind of just a pool of people that have each other's numbers a lot of times and call each other up and are like, hey, man, I got this gig. I need a keyboardist, you know. And it's really good vibes here, man. There's so many just fantastic players, and everybody is kind of vibing off each other and nudging each other along and, you know, making each other a better player all the time. And I feel like you can take that into any other, you know, style of music or band that you're playing in, and it's great.
Does it work the same way as more traditional jazz as we've known it? I only think about Von Freeman and New Apartment Lounge and this concept of people getting up and jamming together. That, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, obviously with Afrobeat, it's a little harder because there's so, like you said, there's a lot more percussion and there's more horns to understand. But is it the same kind of, can you bring other musicians into the fold to say, hey, just follow us in what we're about to do?
I mean, I would say pretty much. You know, you can kind of do that with any genre of music. You know, it's just all a matter of knowing the style and just being able to use, like, musical intuition to go ahead and jam with everyone else.
How about it, legit?
Yeah, I would say the same. It's really just about just following the music, listening to the music, doing what it's speaking to you, I guess.
Well, the Chicago Afrobeat Project will be on stage at Navy Pier coming up here tomorrow night. Free show, part of the Watercolors series presented by CIBC. It is the final show of the Jazz series. Are we going to see this next year? I mean, is this something that you see that will be continuing?
Yeah, I can see this continuing. You know, also, you know, we want to let people know that, you know, we're kind of a year-round destination. I mean, we have programmings coming up in the fall. We have music series. We have a bunch of new shops and retail and stuff. You know, so people come check out. I think people would, you know, generally Chicago people would be surprised when they come to Navy Pier, like, oh man, I didn't realize that it's this nice and it's, you know, really looking great. So I would encourage everyone to check out our website and you know, see what we're doing for this year.
There you go.
Some new cool stuff.
Daniel Crane with Navy Pier. Also, Chicago Afrobeat Project is Kevin Ford, David Glines, Legit, Aria the Second, and you guys will also be at Promontory coming up on Monday in Hyde Park right there on 53rd Street. Thanks everybody for joining us this morning. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Nice.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
Oh, my. 720 WGN.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, the Lafferty. Nice.
When I walked in, I saw.
All right, coming up, Bill and Wendy. Tomorrow, Steve Cochran back on the program. Excited to have him back. We got a big show tomorrow. I don't even know if there's, like, we were just going over the rundown. There's so much great stuff.
There's a lot of good stuff, and Steve's going to be bottled up from all the political news that took place the last 2 days. So.
The first thing we said when we saw the stories yesterday of Manafort and Cohen, I'm like, oh, poor Steve.
I know. He's got to be killing him. I saw he was doing some action on Twitter, so follow him at Steve Cochran Show on Twitter, yeah.
All right. Bill and Wendy here. They're taking over. Hey, guys. How are you?
How are you?
Morning.
Oh, I'm so good. It's a Chicago Afrobeat Project in.
You sounded very good.
Yeah, I know. I wanted them to break out the 14 instruments and do the whole thing.
What happened? How come they didn't?
I just forgot to ask them.
Oh.
They brought all the instruments. I just forgot to ask them.
Oh.
Like you, Bill, a one-man show kind of thing.
Yeah, similar. Yep.
I thought it was weird the guy was holding a trumpet, but I was like, you don't need that to talk. We're gonna stop. No, they too much. Some things we are not equipped to. The 14-piece Afrobeat Project.
That's
probably
all right.
Not
That's
ready.
Okay.
Maybe someday.
It still sounded good.
Yeah. What's up with you guys? What do you got coming up?
We are going to talk to Thomas Ian Nicholas from Rookie of the Year. Oh, what else has he been doing?
He's got a band. He's got a 16-piece band. They're all playing.
They're all
They're all here.
It's
Remember to tell him to play. Yeah.
So, Rookie of the Year, Justin always likes to have his son Miles watch all these old movies that Justin liked as a kid. He forces him on them. And so, Rookie of the Year, though, he hasn't done, so you guys will have to go home and watch it.
I know, and I feel like I have asked... that one has been on... let's watch this movie! And,
Well, you can't run it by him. You just have to say, this is what we're watching.
What's your success rate when showing him a movie that you loved? Are you about 50-50?
50-50, yeah. And it's a lot... Right now, we're on an 80s kick. I brought it up on the show. Die Hard was one that was really edgy for an 11-year-old. And then we also... The second edgy one was Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh.
Which is
was that edgy?
It's not edgy. It's just the F-words and the machine guns are in full effect.
Boy, I don't even remember 80s, that being a big part of it.
You go back and watch all of 80s like blockbusters, and it is violence and language, and you wonder where we're at in our society.
Oh,
I said the F word in front of Miles this morning already, though.
So. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Good.
I never filtered movies for my kids.
No,
I should have. Yeah.
I mean, it is the movies that you consider to be edgy today, where you're like, oh, I don't know if I should show this movie.
Yeah.
Pale in comparison to something that we thought was, oh, it's so fun, a family film, Beverly Hills Cop. No, it is Eddie Murphy on. First of all, Bruce Willis in Die Hard. There's an F-bomb every third sentence. And Beverly Hills Cop, the same thing. There is just swear words. And
boy, you're a good parent.
I'm with Wendy, though, on that filtering. When I first started dating Pat and I met, you know, the kids.
Still show it to them.
I used to look everything up on this, like, website on if it's okay if they watch, because I wanted to make good impressions. You know, I didn't need them going home and telling their mom, like, she showed us this. But then that's out the window and I'll show whatever. I just say don't listen if you don't want
to. If you see something from the 80s that you're like, oh, that looks fun. I remember it being fun and family. Just watch it. And you'll be like,
it'll shock you, right?
A lot of Uzis.
Yeah.
80s love the Uzi. Just Uzi City. All right, have a great show, guys.
The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet weekday mornings at 7:20 on 7:20.